morning, Metsville and baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael Acolant, and I welcome you back to another episode of the Metsian Podcast, episode number 79 of our numbered shows. Somehow, some way, the Mets are still in first place. Let's talk about that and everything else happening along Roosevelt Avenue. Let's bring in my partners and let's bring in this evening's guest and we'll get started. Hailing from Connecticut, Beatles fan, writer for Metsmerized Online, and a fellow New York Giants football fan like myself, Rich Spirago. Hello, my friend.
Hey, Mike. Good evening. How you doing?
Doing well. How are you, sir? How's everything going, man?
Everything's good. You know, I have to say, you know, being a Mets fan, I think we always look up at the sky waiting for the stakes to fall on your head. And I am worried about these next the stretch up to the All-Star break. I'm sure we'll get into that. But, you know, they've got a lot of games. They're a bit depleted on the mound. We'll peel all that back. But that's where my head is at the moment.
We're definitely going to take our temperature. I have a new name for our other partner. I'm calling him the Nor'easter, the human Nor'easter, because we never know where he is. But he's always somewhere in the tri-state area. The converted Mets fan, the proprietor of Bedford and Sullivan, Sam Maxwell. Hello.
Hello, what is going on? It is a beautiful evening in the tri-state area, a beautiful night for baseball, but unfortunately we'll have to deal with seven-inning doubleheaders tomorrow. The players seem to like it. I don't. I wish there was a baseball game tonight, but I would gladly talk to you guys any day of the week, one way or another.
This truly is, as they say, one of those 10 best days of the year. It's spectacular outside. The Nor'easter, folks. Now, you know, at Greenwood Cemetery here in Brooklyn, there's several gentlemen who are laid to rest vying to be the father of baseball. With us this evening is an undisputed forefather of Mets blogging and podcasting. You might know him as the Crane Pool Society. I'll introduce him as Mr. Stephen Keane. Hello and welcome back to the podcast, sir.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. And it's a pleasure to be back with you guys. Thank you for the invitation this evening.
The pleasure is ours. Gentlemen, let's talk baseball. But before we get into Mets talk, let's talk about a couple of, greater, bigger MLB issues. And first and foremost is the sticky stuff. I'm not even going to call it by what it's being called. To me, it's just sticky stuff. Inspection started Monday. And, you know, we have people who are falling in line, who are putting up with the inspections. Jacob deGrom got inspected. He was very low-key and quiet about it. On the other hand, we have some people who are just, you know, making this a drama. Max Scherzer, he overreacted. Sergio Romer, he overreacted. And even Scherzer and Joe Girardi, you know, they exchanged looks, dirty looks, mean-spirited looks, and, you know, left to their own druthers, they would have gotten into a fight. Here's where we are, the New World Order under Commissioner Manfred. So, Stephen, I will start with you, the sticky stuff, and, you know, what is going on here? And why do they make this so hard on themselves?
Well, they make it so hard on themselves because you have like the worst commissioner in the history of commissioners. And I'm talking not just sports, maybe city government too. I mean, this guy is, he's actually, what I don't understand is how do you make these rules in like the middle of a season? And where's the Players Association in this? I mean, the union should be screaming saying, listen, you can't just come up with new rules in the middle of a season. And it's really to a disadvantage to a lot of these pitchers because they're all saying that they need to have something to grip these baseballs. These baseballs are very slick. It used to be that the baseballs were rubbed up with mud that came from the Delaware River or something, and umpires, that was part of their job.
That's still the case.
Really? Yeah, but... And I thought that would be what would help with the grip. Then most guys, they say, would use sunscreen and mix that with rosin, and that gave them a little bit of you know, tackiness. Then they come up with this stuff, Spite Attack, that I think they should weightlifters use this. And that stuff is almost like super glue. And, I mean, I don't know who – I mean, I know offense is down. And I've never seen guys who can throw sliders and sinkers that just, like, break all the way down and fool hitters the way they've been doing it. And the quality of the game is not what it once was. So I'm guessing that this is the reason why they felt that they had to do something to give the offense a little more of an advantage than they've had. But I don't understand how you change rules. In, it's not really changing the rule. It's enforcing a rule that's been on the books that hasn't really been enforced in years, or maybe since Gaylord Perry and the Negro brothers, and Joe Negro especially. And it just seems that everything with baseball is always something off the field that's the controversy. You never hear about what's going on the field. And I think that takes away from the game. And like I say, Rob Manfred is, I don't know. The only way I guess he keeps his job is that he gets big contracts from ESPN and TBS and Fox for baseball. And he's putting money in the owner's pockets. And that's all they care about. They don't care about the aesthetics of the game. They don't care about the fan experience of the game. They care about what's in the fans' pockets, their money. And as long as they're getting that, they're fine. So as baseball fans, we look at this and we're like, it's an embarrassment. The players don't like it. I mean, like you say, you see some guys, you saw like Max Scherzer, like he was like, he looked like a WWE wrestler, like him and Girardi were ready to go at it. And then you see Sergio Romo of the A's, he just pulled his pants down. He said, hey, you want to check everything? You know, I'll turn my head and cough. What do you want? You know, you want to see everything. And then our guy yesterday, Tyler Megill, kid coming out, major league debut, pitching. He's in a situation where we need this arm. Where, you know, guys are getting hurt left and right. Pitches great. Comes out to a big standing ovation. But hold on. Stop asking Frisk. What do you got there? Let's see what you got. And the poor kid, he's like, fine, here, check me. I got, you know, I don't have anything. And it just ruins the whole thing. And you just look at it and you shake your head and you're like, you know, what? Where's the leadership? There's lack of leadership. I mean, how does anybody come up with these things that time and time again just embarrass the game?
Well said. Rich, last week I had mentioned that 100 years ago this summer, baseball contemplated instituting the rosin bag for pitchers because grip is indeed an issue. Of these inspections are terrible. And once again, they're shooting themselves in the foot. What say you?
Clearly they are. And when something is, you know, as much as Rob Manfred and his cohorts might be out of touch, they clearly see what's happening, that they see that this is a mockery. And they know it's a mockery. You know, you have people like the Romo unbuckling his pants, almost dropping his pants, you know, on the field and all that. And it's an absolute joke. So then you start to think, what are they trying to get out of it, right? And because they're not helping the game, that's clear. And the only conclusion you could come to, and I asked you guys to jump in on this, but, you know, I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist, but the only thing you can come to is it's trying to divide the union in some way in preparation for the labor negotiations, because you're not helping the game. You're not helping the pitcher. You're not helping the hitter. The pitchers and the hitters are actually kind of unified here. I mean, the pitchers want to be able to grip the ball better because of the seam issue. The hitters are standing in the box with guys throwing harder than ever, and they want these guys to be able to spot the ball and control the ball. So they are not generally opposed to having the pitchers, you know, use some sticky substance or whatever it might be. So what are you trying to do? I mean, you could change the seams on the ball. You could do a lot of different things, but instead you're doing this stuff. And you guys, tell me if you see something I'm not seeing, and I mean that candidly. I can't see any other motivation to destroy the game, or not destroy the game, but to make a mockery of the game play other than the upcoming labor negotiation. They have to feel like they're dividing the union. That's the only thing I can come up with.
ponderous. Sam, take it away.
We don't like to necessarily get into politics here, but I'm going to mention Trump when it comes to any good PR. Any PR is good PR. Right now, I guarantee you, all of that shenanigans were on both the front page of many papers around the country, if that is such a thing anymore. But it was definitely trending all over all the social media. It probably made the news of anybody who's still watching those morning shows. People are talking about baseball, even if it's a mockery. One way or another, you know you're going to see something wacky. They zoomed in on the crowd, and there was somebody who was very curious who mouthed, what is going on out there? Yes, the game, it's not, we're not looking at the game as much. But people, these are getting clicks. This is definitely getting clicks right now. And again, it might not be all positive, but that is also maybe something he's thinking about. Rich, I think you're completely right when it comes to the labor negotiations. How this even gets across and able to be something that gets implemented, the over-checking, gets implemented in the middle of the season. I don't get it. It's completely, I don't know how the union even let it happen, number one. Number two, this is how ass backwards both Rob Manfred and baseball's generally been, but right now Rob Manfred has made it worse than I've ever seen. Why are they being checked after they perform? Why are they not being checked before they perform? This is the problem, right? That they're going on to the mound having put stuff on. Why is it backwards where Tyler McGill has to be checked on the way off to a great rookie performance? It doesn't make any sense. Check them on the way if you're going to even do it. If we're outside of getting into the debate about them needing a grip, if this is what you're going to implement in the middle of the season, why are you doing it after they perform the inning? Do it before they perform the inning. It's ridiculous.
It really is. And for that matter, look, we know pitchers touch the ball the most often out of anybody in the field. Who touches the ball second most often? The catcher. Who touches the ball third most often? Your first baseman. Why aren't they checking them? They can easily put something on the ball and hand it right back to the pitcher. So it's just, you know, stupidity on an uber level going on here. Let's continue bashing MLB and Manfred. Let's talk all-star uniforms. I think they're ugly. If they were trying to do something original, they failed, and they failed miserably. I think they're horrific, ugly. Steven, what say you?
They're horrible. It looks like there was absolutely no thought put into these uniforms. I don't understand the color of them. I don't understand the lettering on the side of them. It looks like something that it was just like thrown together. And you know, how much of this stuff can they sell? Who's buying all this stuff? Mother's Day hats, Father's Day hats, Memorial Day hats, 4th of July hats, the Sunday hats. It's like, there's a hat and a shirt for every occasion. Festivus hats. There's everything. Now they come out with these things. And as soon as they come out with it, I'm getting emails from Fanatics and all the and the Mets and buy this, buy that. I'm not buying them anymore. They're horrible. I don't understand it. It's like, did there ever come a point where they say, you know what, we just can't sell any more stuff? Do they sell all these things? Are people buying all these things? The uniforms are horrible. I mean, they have lettering down the side, and they have the team name is in with the city. I don't know. It's just and the hats and everything. It's just they just try and either I don't know if they're trying too hard or if they just don't care. It's like it's one or the other. I just it's just oversaturation of these things. It just after a while, it's like You know, I have a Mets jersey with Lasting's millage name and number on it. I'm good with that. I'll stick with that.
Sam, somebody in MLB marketing got paid a lot of money to come up with these uniforms. What do you think?
I think they need to go back to what worked, which was going with the ballpark that you were there in. That worked for the Mets. I mean, plenty of people have those. You basically got a chance to see some future Mets or Mets that got traded too early in a Mets uniform. So for a Mets fan, the 2013 All-Star Game uniforms worked. But if you look at some point, I mean, like I could pull it up after having looked at these awful 2021 uniforms. I mean, like, you know, I'm basically choking on my own saliva looking at them. I just can't. I can't handle it because somebody, did they focus group these things? I mean, just like who are they out there marketing these to? You know, because especially like,
sure.
Right. Like, you know, some of it has drop shadow. Like we've been there before. It's just, I just don't understand what they are thinking. The only one that I will say doesn't look half bad is the Tampa Bay dark blue jersey with gold kind of lettering. That's not a half bad looking jersey, but then when you look at the rest of them, it just doesn't work. You know, maybe the darker colored one works better than the solid whites, but marginally better. Because of the ugly lettering behind the main logo. Again, it works better with the if you guys look at some of these links, go to sportslogos.net, the news piece. If you look at that, the Tampa Bay one's not terrible compared to the ugly Colorado white jersey. That's not as bad. That's the only thing I'll give them credit for.
What do you think, Rich?
Well, it's time for me to lapse into cranky old man mode because they're ugly. I agree with you guys completely. And it's like, I'm with Steve. It's like, what are you – we get it. You're trying to sell merchandise. You know, the Mets – everybody wants this black. Can't wait for the black. Sure, it's all this kind of stuff. Okay, fine. Whether you like them or you don't. We know why they have them. They have them to sell an alternate jersey, just like the Cubs with their blue and the Mets with their blue and all this kind of stuff. You know, I've had enough of it, frankly. I really have. To me, the Mets home uniforms are white pinstripe with, you know, blue and orange. If whether you have a pullover or a button-down, change it season to season if you like pullovers or button-downs, whatever. But that's your home uniform. The Mets classic gray on the road, great. And here's where I have to say, you know, you have to give the New York Yankees credit here because they don't do that. And I'm sorry, no Mets fans don't want to hear that. And I hate giving the Yankees credit for anything, but at least they stick to their uniforms. Like it's the pinstripe, it's classic at home, the gray on the road. They don't do this kind of crap that it's nothing but crap. It's just designed to sell uniforms. And like Steve said, I'm sick of seeing the Memorial Day hat, which honors, you know, a big part of U.S. history in the military. Then the 4th of July hat has to be different than the Memorial Day hat for some strange reason. And then you have to have the alternate home, the alternate road. Now you have to have several alternates. Then you have to have this all-star thing now. Those things the Red Sox wore in April that I think a lot of teams are wearing, you know, those whatever the company was, I forgot who even sponsored them. The Red Sox looked like they were playing in mustard. And it's like, it's got to stop. You know, it really, stuff like that, just it grinds my gears. You know, it really does. And you know what?
You got a little mustard on those socks right there, Rich?
There you go. You know, I'll just leave it as saying it one more time, painful as it is for me to say. Everybody should be the Yankees when it comes to uniforms. This is our home. That's our away. Deal with it. So that's my old man, get off my lawn speech.
I'm with you. Rich, I'm going to stay with you, and this is standalone for you. You brought up a great point in our pre-show talk about attendance. You've been witnessing the transition and the crowds growing and fluctuating at Citi Field. Take us through that, from the few to the many.
Well, you know, I went in April when it was, you know, 10% or whatever it was. It was like 8,000 people, 20%. And okay, you know, it was 8,000 people, but it felt great just to be there. I have to say, there was no traffic, which was wonderful. You know, you pull right in, right, you get right out. There was no line for food and all that stuff. So all that, in a strange sort of a way, was kind of very, you know, fan-friendly. But okay, it felt great to be there. We all knew why we were doing it this way. Then as I went in June and it was 70% against the Padres on a Sunday afternoon, I'm looking around and I'm thinking, and actually the attendance at the game was 16,000. Now that's not 70% of 44 or 42,000. So I'm like, where the hell is everybody? It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon. They're playing the Padres. You could put about 30,000 in this place, and there's only half of that here. About 16,000 were there. You watch these games this week, the place is empty, and it could go to full capacity. So I'm wondering, you know, you could go with the obvious here. Maybe people just aren't comfortable where there are no masks and stuff, and I understand that. If people don't want to go because they don't want to be in that environment, I completely understand that. But I'm wondering if that's it. Is that the reason why people aren't going? Because you look at other ballparks, the Braves are packing them in down in Atlanta. You know, the Yankees are doing fairly well attendance-wise. So my question is, Mets fans, where the heck are you? And why aren't you coming out to Citi Field? You know, I mean, it would be unique, as far as I'm concerned, if they said it was entirely COVID and being concerned, which, again, I would respect that. It seems like the Mets are the only fan base that's going through it. You know, the Red Sox pack them in. The Yankees are doing well. Where is everybody? I don't know. And the team's in first place. Let me add that. They're in first place. Where the hell is everybody? I don't know.
That's a great point, Rich. Let's talk about this first place team. The Mets are presently 38-31. They're idle today. For the moment, they hold a 4-game lead in the division. They're 22-9 at home. Let me throw out a couple other things here for your digestion. Despite being last in the National League in hits, last in total bases, and last in runs scored, they've struck out the least amongst National League clubs. I find that a little odd that those stats would be in the same sentence. They're following an old algorithm, pitching and defense, and timely hitting is a distant third. So wherever you want to go with this, we just came off a series with Washington. We lost 3 out of 4. We just split 2 with Atlanta, and we got Philly coming up. The last time we faced Philly, we won 2 out of 3. And just for giggles, against our division foes, we have a 5-3 record against Atlanta, a 6-3 record against Philly, and a 3-4 record against Washington. And, yes, I'm leaving Miami out of the equation. So, Stephen, the New York Mets, what say you?
It's incredible with the amount of injuries and with the lack of offense that this team is in first place, and it's in first place by a lot. It also helps that the division is not what we all thought it was going to be. The Braves are down this year. The Nationals are down, but they're starting to play better. Philadelphia hasn't really played well, and Miami is doing what Miami does. But it's funny how all these injuries, how the infield got so much better defensively, and the outfield did too, especially in center field. And I don't know what's going to happen because now everybody's coming back. And when I look at the infield, you know, it's going to be Alonso, it'll be McNeil and Lindor. Third base, I think you got to keep VR there. I think that he's going to have to be the regular third baseman. I think, you know, a lot of people don't think you should lose a job when you get injured. I don't think J.D. Davis plays as well as Jonathan VR plays in the field, and his aggressiveness on the bases. I think he's going to have to stay there. But they're getting pitching. I mean, we have the greatest pitcher in the universe in DeGrom. Marcus Stroman has shown us that, you know, he's a top line pitcher. And then Taijuan Walker coming off Tommy John, we have a solid three. David Peterson, who was shaky early, he's pitched well. And we have a bullpen, especially Edwin Diaz, who, you know, 2 years ago we were like, what's going on here? This guy was a star in Seattle, and he was terrible, and now he's back to being like one of the top closers in baseball again. And I think there's also, you have to look at the chemistry of this team too. This is a team, you know, not just that they like each other, they pull for each other. It, you know, and you got to give credit to Louis Rojas for this, because I think the main job of a baseball manager today is not who you bring in the seventh inning to pitch and this and that. And I know Mets Twitter blows up like crazy for some of his in-game moves, but his big strength is his communication skill with these players. People kind of forget, this guy's been in this organization for almost 15 years. He knows most of he managed a lot of these guys in the minor leagues. They all know him. They all respect him. And it seems that players just want to know, what do you want me to do? What is my job? Where do I fit? And Rojas is the kind of guy that will tell you, okay, you're going to pitch this inning. You'll pitch that inning. You're going to play today, and you won't play tomorrow, but I'm going to bring you back on Saturday. And I think that's the main part of it, too, that the communication in the dugout is as good as it's been in a long, long time. Team understands that everybody has a job to do, and everybody's doing it. It's kind of like the Bill Belichick, do your job. And I think everybody on this team knows their job and does their job. And we're not used to this, because we're waiting for the sky to fall. You know, injuries every day, somebody's hurt. Somebody pulls a hamstring or a hip. Something's wrong with their hip. Or you get injuries like Nimmo and J.D. Davis, these weird injuries where there's like nerve damage in a finger and they can't play for 2 months. Guys step up, and that's the mark of a really good team. When a guy goes down, another guy comes in and kicks the other guy up, you know, the next man up. And it seems that this team, better than any team in the division, has that next man up mentality and has been able to do it.
First place, yes. Anxiety, yes. Let me just throw this out there. Tyler McGill, 92 pitches in 4.1 innings, gave up 2 runs on 3 hits and 2 walks, struck out 4. Congratulations to him. But, Sam, Steven brings up a great point. You know, timing. Has the bench mob run its course? And, you know, it seems like Conforto and McNeil, they're coming back in very timely fashion, just when we need them most. You know, we have 2 scoreless games back-to-back against Atlanta. Second half of the twin bill and that game on Tuesday. So, like I said, we were just hoping for them to extend us into June and through June. So anywhere you want to go.
Well, there's many places that Stephen just went that I'd like to go, you know, veer off in a tangent in some fashion. And I'll start with the Washington series. I think they were due, and Washington has been hot. You know, Kyle Hendricks kind of threw the offense off, and they struggled for a few days, except for Francisco Lindor in the doubleheader. And with the Atlanta series, I think, you know, just when you thought they were going to run out of that bench mob magic, last night, it was really the bullpen bench mob that really came through. You know, on top of the offense, doing what we always want them to do is just don't die on the vine after scoring 5 in the first 2 innings. You know, keep battling, and you know, they were able to get a couple more runs, and that proved to – and what I loved about that specifically last night – was the fact that those 2 runs came after Edwin Diaz came in for the save. So he was there with a 4-run lead, but still protecting his save numbers. And as we saw, that was the difference. Now going, kind of tying that back into the way that Rojas has been using him, I would really appreciate if people stopped using Edwin Diaz on the road with a tie game in the bottom of the ninth inning anywhere. you know, whether it's Washington, whether whatever it is, don't do it, please. But with Rojas, if you've been paying attention, even though he does all these losses, sometimes just do have some what we would consider just bonehead plays, and it's very minute maneuvering that we're talking about here. I think that as much as people like to say that it's all the front office, Luis Rojas is a very active manager on that bench. Every time they're going, you know, for one, he is a master griller of the ump. There's plenty of times that we're picking up this very subtle, you see it right on Rojas' face, how unhappy he is with the way the ump is going about his business. And I appreciate that about him. He is always talking. They're always talking about the game on the bench. You know, if he's got the mask on, he removes it for a second so he can properly say something to somebody nearby. You know, that's what I've been seeing out there. I love that Conforto came right back and didn't miss a beat. He said that it's the best his legs have ever felt, and if you're kind of watching if you think about that while you watch some of those highlights, you kind of see what he's talking about. So hopefully that holds up and this conditioning holds up, because I saw something somewhere out there, and here's where I'll pass it back to you, Mike. Somebody was saying that really the team doesn't have anything to do with conditioning anymore, that it's all individual players. It's all whoever is conditioning that specific athlete. And that's something to think about.
Certainly is. We're waiting for Jerry Familia to come back from the IL. We lost Gesellman, Lucchesi, Tommy John surgery, Stroman and DeGrom. They're feeling a little creaky. But Rich, take it away. Your biggest impression so far.
Well, you know, with the Mets, it's kind of, to me, it's kind of obvious how they've won, at least in my opinion. You look at the core starters, right? You have DeGrom, you know, we know. In fact, I just happen to have his stats in front of me here. He started 12 games this year. These were video game stats. I mean, he started 12 games. He has a .50 ERA. In 72 innings, he's allowed 27 hits. Let that one sink in. He's allowed 4 earned runs over 72 innings with 117 strikeouts and a whiff of 0.51. So you have him at the top of your rotation. You have Marcus Stroman, and you've got Taijuan Walker, who both have ERAs in the mid-2s, which in this day and age is you know, like, that's the kind of stuff when we were kids, you know? So that's amazing for this day and age. So clearly the starting pitching, you know, Peterson has been up and down, and you got some really good starts out of Lucchesi. So the reason they're in first place, as far as I'm concerned, clearly a function of the starting rotation. The bullpen has been very good in general. So it's been a pitching issue. You know, they've outpitched their competition. I mean, let's let this one sink in, too. They were winning games with guys like Jake Hager, Jasweny Fargas. You know, they're winning games with guys like that on the field. You know, Mason Williams. And how do you win games with that kind of an offense, you know, with that kind of a top-gun offense? Well, you win them because you have a really good pitching staff, which they do. So that's how I see it. And it's just weird that now that the lineup is getting healthy, they're almost there. If they get J.D. Davis back and Nimmo back, which, by the way, you know, I think it was Steve who said, how in 2021 they could say it was a nerve issue, it was this, and a month later they say it was a ligament? I mean, it blows my mind that the doctors couldn't figure this one out, that it was a ligament issue with Nimmo. But anyway, so when they get Nimmo and Davis back, they'll be at full strength offensively, but they've been winning on the premise of pitching. You know, their starters have been first in Major League Baseball. Their overall team ERA is in like second or third all year, so that's how they're doing it. And my concern is when the pitching is the piece propelling you, and now the injuries have shifted from the position players to the pitching. That gives me a little pause, because that has been the formula. So I'm a little concerned, you know, with the Lucchesi's going out and Gesellman being out. You're weakening the bullpen a little bit there. we hope Stroman won't miss significant time. You know, granted, the MRI was clean, but we hope that won't happen. So in summary, the formula for me has been very good starting pitching, very solid bullpen, you know, doing enough to score just to win. But I am concerned now that the injury bug has shifted to the pitching staff, because that has been the formula.
Sam, you got something you want to get off your chest. What's up?
Well, we're talking pitching, we're talking defense, and I think where the offense wins is the fact that they've struck out the least, like you said, Mike. That is the proper way that you also sprinkle in timely hitting. Don't strike out. Make sure you are protecting that two strikes. That's basically what it says to me, is if they've struck out the least, it's not that they, you know, I'd love to see that correlating with how many times they've had two strikes on them. But my guess is that they have protected against the two strikes. And that has been one of the things that's kept them alive. That's been one of the things that has led to the timely hitting. Because if you can keep the at-bat alive, it does skew your way, as you know, from an offensive perspective.
You know what, Sam? Can't say that about the rest of the organization. Max Metz, they covered it. The strikeouts within the minor league systems are outrageous. And I talked to John from Albany about this as well. The rest of the four teams, the strikeouts are through the roof. It's unbelievable. Just wanted to throw that out there. Anyway, what was my next point? Going once, going twice. Okay, here we go. I got it. Underachievers, this is where we start taking temperatures, guys. We're going to put some couple of these fellows under the heat lamp. And you tell me, you know, yay or nay. Let's start with Dom Smith. Is this a man languishing still without a position? I mean, we can only take this criticism so far because, after all, they are in first place. But still, put him under the microscope. And along with him, Pete Alonso and Francisco Lindor. All three of them have over 200 at-bats. Are they up to snuff? Is their performance copacetic with you? Or are they underachieving? Because these three have stayed together as a block with all these injuries. And you would think other teams would gladly take these three and insert them in the middle of their lineup. That's kind of my point. So, Steven, I'll let you start.
Well, I'm a huge Dominic Smith fan. I love Dominic Smith. And I watched him this year, and this is not the same guy. His approach has been fooled by these back foot sliders constantly, and he's been missing on balls that he usually hits. He's starting to hit a little better. He's starting to hit left-handed pitching a little better, and he's starting to use the gap, which is what he's not a home run hitter. He's not a 40 home run hitter. He's a guy with some power. And again, he's playing out of position. Now, the only thing you can hope is once they get a new CBA, we're probably going to have a universal designated hitter. That would definitely help, because his best position is definitely first base. So if you can have him and Alonso's time between first base and DH, to me, that's a big plus for the Mets. I mean, I'm hoping that as we're getting now into the warmer weather and they're playing so many games in a row that he gets games all the time, that this is going to pick up and that he's going to start hitting the way I think he can hit. I see him getting fooled by a lot of off-speed pitches, breaking balls, like I said, especially the sliders that go in the dirt. I don't know. He's not picking the ball up right. I mean, I don't know, but he has these little spurts where I think, okay, now he's going to break out of it, and then he reverts back to where he's not picking up the ball. So I'm hoping that we get further into the summer and the hot weather and playing a lot, because they have the doubleheader tomorrow. We have I think it's something like 33 games in 31 days. It's like some weird part of the schedule. So I'm hoping, I mean, you know, it's true. I mean, he has how many at-bats? He has 221 at-bats, and he's hitting .244. I don't think that's the real Dominic Smith. I'm hoping that he can come through and show what he showed last year. Last year was in an abbreviated season. He was terrific. We just have to. I'm going to wait and see. I'm not ready to get rid of Dom Smith yet.
Rich, how you feel?
Well, when it comes to Dom, you know, I think Steve's right. Well, let me start with the positive. I was very much against Dom being a left fielder because I'm, you know, Mike, you and I talk about this all the time. I'm big on defense in baseball. I think it's a very important part of the game, and Dom looked like a fish out of water, at least as far as I was concerned. You know, he had, if you remember, when he got some run out in left field, I think it was starting back late 2017, he had never played the outfield even in the minor leagues. He was learning it in the major league level. And I didn't think that was really fair to him. And he did look shaky out there, you know, 18, 19, 20. And I was kind of rolling my eyes thinking, you know, how can they put this guy out there and expect to be a World Series team, you know, a contending team, when you have a guy learning on the job? But he has been a damn acceptable left fielder. So I'll give him, you know, I want to give him some props there because the game is two sides, right? And I think he's exceeded expectations defensively, and I think by a lot, at least for my own expectations. Now looking at his offensive numbers, well, so here's a guy who last year just looked like one of those pure hitters, kind of like a Keith Hernandez, you know, line drives all over the place, every now and then jacking one out of here, great. Well, now, this year, you know, .244 batting average, on-base percentage is also low at .319. So, you know, and he's not showing power. He only 6 home runs, which projects, you know, probably to about 14, 15 on the season. So if you look at these numbers, if Dom's going to end up, you know, let's just say he ends up at .260, .265 with maybe 15 home runs, that's a letdown. That, you know, based on what we saw of him, especially the back half of 19 before he got hurt, and then in 20, I don't think anybody's expecting those numbers. I think we all expected better. So I'd say his overall ledger, yeah, he's been a disappointment. While he's exceeding expectations defensively, he's pretty significantly below them offensively. And can you imagine, though, in the back half of the season, if Dom kicks it in, how welcome that will be and what it will do to this offense to have his back going again when these guys all come back? I mean, that's something really intriguing.
And do you think if he was playing first base regularly that his numbers would reflect that, Sam?
I don't know necessarily. I think he's gotten comfortable enough out there that it's not like he's really, you know, struggling offensively because he's too concerned what he's doing defensively. I think there's certain points where you still see that he's not a natural left fielder, but they come in very short spurts now. Generally speaking, he takes great routes to the ball and sometimes even better routes. I'm going to take, because we've talked so much about, you know, the lack of offense coming from Dom, and it's true, and I'm a big Dom fan as well, and I do believe he's going to turn it around. I do want to point out, when we're talking about Pete Alonso's numbers, and he's just now batting .250, which is good because he's generally been batting in the .240s lately, but he's only got 11 home runs, and I think this is something that Pete is probably thinking about when it comes to the ball. Something I think I meant to mention and might have mentioned on another podcast, but meant to mention when we were talking about the ball and the foreign substances, is the idea that baseball has been changing the ball, which does kind of throw comparable stats from generation to generation, intergenerational comparison, out the window if you're talking about a completely different ball from year to year. And considering now that we know there's probably a lot of foreign substances used with some of these Hall of Famers that we're even talking about. But that's a whole other story for a whole other day. When you look at Pete Alonso's numbers here, he has 35 RBIs, 250 batting average, 11 home runs, with 52 hits and 208 at-bats, 0.9 WAR right now. On-base percentage, 335, and that slugging percentage, 447, could certainly use a little bump. I don't know exactly what is going on with Pete Alonso, but I think that we'd all believe that we'd hope he'd be at least 20 home runs with the best of them out there right now. When you're talking about some of these home run numbers that we're hearing from some of the very young ball players in Major League Baseball, Pete Alonso, who will still be in the home run derby because all those 11 home runs were crazy shots. Still, they're containing him. And that's probably a big of what the opposition is trying to do when going in there. The Mets, like we've been saying, have put themselves in good position currently. But if Pete Alonso are up, who knows where they could be. So right now the opposition is containing Pete Alonso. And when we're talking about those ugly all-star uniforms, I'd be glad if Pete Alonso, who probably shouldn't be in the all-star game, doesn't wear that uniform.
You're listening to the Metsian Podcast, and our guest this evening is the original settler and governor of Cranepool Society, Mr. Stephen Keen. Stephen, Michael Conforto's back, and pitchers better be in trouble. He only has a half a season left to earn a contract.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting to see they handle this with Conforto. I don't know how much money he's looking for or how much a length of a contract he's looking for. I think what is in his favor is that he's a homegrown Met. He's a leader on this team for sure, and with Scott Boras as his agent, you know, you figure he's going to start asking for something, you know, big money and long term, and it's really tough because, you know, you gave all the money to Lindor, then you have Conforto. I think with Jake DeGrom, you got to renegotiate his contract and bump him up and make sure that he's a Met for life. I think you got to try to do something there. So I don't know. I don't know. That, you know, Conforto is that strong silent type where when he's asked about does he think about it, he gives you the answer, you know, the stock answer. No, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about, you know, my hits. I'm worried about winning this and that. It's got to be playing on him a little bit, especially with that hamstring injury that cost him a lot of time. You got to see now. He came back with a bit of a vengeance last night. Got his hits. He's excellent in right field. He's solid. To me, hopefully he stays a Met for a long time. But this is going to be very interesting to see what he's looking for and what the Mets decide. I don't think, you know, we have to get used to this owner who has money. But I don't know, you know, I don't know, does he want to? He says he'll go over the tax. How much he'll go over that tax, we don't know. I mean, nobody talks about Joe Tsai that owns the Brooklyn Nets. He has told, like, Sean Marks, whatever you got to go over, if you're telling me it's going to get us to a championship, we'll pay the tax. We'll go over. I want to see if Steve Cohen has that same mentality where if they say, well, if we sign this guy and this guy, it's going to put us over. We're going to pay the tax. And if he says, well, listen, if you're telling me that this is going to bring us this much closer to a championship, worry about the tax. I'll pay it. We have to wait and see with this because – I'm always trying to figure out what would be the right perfect contract for a Michael Conforto. I don't think he's a $25 million a year player. Is he an $18 million a year player? For how many years? 5 years? Is that Is that the kind of contract? Is he, you know, are we talking like $100 million, $125 million for 5 years? Does that get it done? Is that an investment that they want to make? The rest, we have to just monitor him and watch him the rest. I'm hope, look, for our sake, as Mets fans, got to hope that he just goes on a major tear and, you know, just starts hitting, because he does get streaky and force the hand of Sandy Alderson and the owner, Steve Cohen, to meet a price and to keep him as a Met.
Mike, can I interject here? When looking at the outfielders in the free agent, and I'm going to pass this on to Rich. This is my question for Rich. If you look at this, go to MLB Trade Rumors and look at the 2021-22 MLB free agents. Is there really a better free agent on the market? And you see a lot of people in their 30s here. Michael Conforto is going to be 29 at the start of this contract. Rich, is there anybody else on this list, if you go to it, who you would sign other than Michael Conforto? And that is really the question here. Or other than developing?
Well, you know, I'm probably not the best guy to ask, because I'm a huge Michael Conforto fan, and I would love nothing more to see them retain him long term. You know, for the reasons, you know, homegrown guy, 2015 World Series, team leader, strong silent type, all the things I've heard, I would love to see him sign the long-term contract. I have to tell you, though, with where I see it right now, and I'd ask you guys to jump in, I don't think it's going to happen. I think they're going to let him become a free agent, and I'll tell you why I think that. The injury, I think, has something to do with it. You know, he's leaving something on the table this year so far. They are big into Lindor, of course. They're going to be bigger into DeGrom, because let's not forget he can opt out after next season. And, you know, they probably have to pony up some more money there. I don't know what they're going to do with Alonso in a few years when he's eligible. But I could see, because outfielders are more plentiful, not that I would sign any of these guys necessarily over Conforto, and I really would. I'm trying to be objective, and I don't think I would objectively. But, you know, Cohen said the other day, did everybody catch what he said about putting a roof on Citi Field? He said, I have a lot of money, but it's not endless. So I think that same thing applies to players, right? He's going to have a budget. It's not going to be a Wilpon budget, but it is going to be a budget. And you can't put everybody in there. You know, you just can't. You know, and so I really think they're going to let Conforto hit the free agent market. And if it turns out that, you know, that the offers aren't there and they could get him back, great. But I don't think they're going to shed any tears if they lose him. I hate to say that, but that's just how I see it going. Some people said the reason that they got Khalil Lee, a guy who, you know, clearly needed one more year in AAA, which he's getting now after, you know, a cup of coffee, was because they're thinking that Conforto might be gone. And that was the reason they went out and got this guy, you know, a stud AA guy, give him a year. And in case they don't bring Conforto back, he could maybe be somebody you think about putting in right field as one option. So, and I heard that from a few of the writers. So if that's true, and they're already disaster planning, you know, in February of last year or January when they made the Mets deal, and then subsequently traded one of those guys for Lee, I have to think their thought process already is, we're not going to go all in at this guy, let him hit the market, see what happens, and if we have to, you know, we have Lee, we have people we could try to acquire, you know, fill in somewhere, we already have a deep and long lineup, we're not going to go $27 million a year for this guy. That's what I think is happening. But if you guys see it differently, let me know.
I want to see one thing. He has 83 games left in the regular season. At some point, I want to see him carry this team for 2 or 3 weeks. I want to see him have a stretch of 30 runs batted in 30 games, because he's yet to do that. He needs to show me he can be a big, big impactful player in this lineup. There's a lot of his game that we look at through orange-colored glasses. I love Conforto. I think I'm just being a pragmatist. a hard-ass one at that. So unless you guys have any other outstanding issues, going once, going twice, let's jump into the DeLorean, to the year 1979. Oh, boy. Guys,
yeah.
To date, this was their worst season at the gate ever. Rich was part of it. I was part of it. Steven was part of it. No Met fan had ever seen Shea Stadium that empty. 1979. We have a lot to say. Steven, I'll start with you.
Boy, this was like the we were in like limbo, like purgatory. The SIVA trade done. Lorenzo Di Lorenzo, now the owner, didn't want to be the owner, wants to dump this team, wants to move on, wants to sell the team. We're like a year away from the team being sold. Joe Torre is the manager. I think he was still player manager then. Doc Ellis pitched for the 79 Mets. Not on LSD, but straight. Nothing in him.
Hey, 1979. Studio 54 was still around.
Yes,
yeah,
it was.
I know the place pretty good. I was in that studio. I've been to studio. I've been to studio. I've been to a lot of these. That could be another 2-hour show. Clubs of the 70s and 80s. I got some great stories.
Oh boy.
I have some great stories about Rusty's restaurant too on the East Side.
That'll be our general New York podcast that Mike and I will start.
I have two Rusty stories from his restaurant actually. So go ahead.
Yeah, but 79. I mean, and of course, the great Digger, Richie Hebner, the one guy who hated to be a New York Met, who saluted the Met fans, those few of us that were in attendance at games at Shea Stadium with the middle finger salute because he was being booed and he didn't want to be there. We didn't want him there. It was really, I mean, I don't, did they drew like maybe 600,000 people, I think, that year or something. It was something like really low.
I'll take a look.
Okay. Yeah, the exact number was 788,000, their lowest to date.
You know,
wow. Yeah.
You know, Mike, for 1937, that wasn't half bad.
Not for 1937, no.
It wasn't just that. The stadium was falling apart. It was. Yeah. I don't think they even opened the upper deck. There were hardly any concession stands open. It was pretty depressing. It was it was a really bad time. That was rough. I mean,
yeah,
so Mike,
we've seen some rough times with this organization, but when you those late 70s, man, that was brutal.
79 really was brutal. Sam, what?
But before you go around the horn regarding 1979 with the people that were alive then, because I was not, I just wanted to say, when you look at the schedule and you see if you're just looking at it from a baseball reference perspective, going through schedule and results, they at some point could have salvaged just a little bit of the season, not necessarily gone crazy and made the playoffs, but every so often you see a longer losing streak as the season goes on, as it gets deeper. At some point they win a few in a row in the middle of July, but then they go, you know, teeter, loss, win, loss, win, you know. And then by the end, you just keep seeing it get deeper and deeper until after, let's see, 9 losses in a row. They broke the streak, but then lost 3 in a row. Then you go 9, brought them to 56
in 98, and they win one against the Cubs at Wrigley Field 3-1. But then they lose for their 99th loss. And Joe Torre, what I've heard, made a point to make sure that they didn't lose 100 games. And then they finished the season with a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 game winning streak to make sure they finished 63-99, finishing off beating St. Louis in St. Louis 4-2, a team that Keith was probably on. I'd be interested to go down that rabbit hole of the box score. But, Mike, I'm going to leave it at that in terms of positivity, even though it was one of the worst seasons, probably arguably from all Metsian perspectives, the worst Mets season in, on record. Joe Torre was able to get that done.
Rich, 1979 was a year. I mean, when you look at the numbers, you know, it's almost laughable, and I think we're doing this in fun anyway. There were a couple of players on that team I actually liked. I liked Jose Cardenal. I remember him being a Met. I was happy when they got him. You know, obviously he was at the very end of his career, but Jose Cardenal is a very colorful player. He was fun to watch. You know, we had Mazzilli on the team who, you know, had a decent year overall. I mean, he hit 303 for the Mets that year, right? So 303 with 15 home runs. You look at the Grave Digger, you know, we don't use his name, but he hit 268 with 10 home runs. And, you know, I liked Doug Flynn. I liked Frank Tavares. I was a huge Frank Tavares fan, by the way. My friends and I used to always say that, you know, when Tavares comes up to the plate, at least he's a threat, you know, because he could bunt. He could do a lot of things. When he gets on base, he could steal. And he was a former stolen base champion. So they had some fun players. Doug Flynn was an absolute magician with the glove. I love Joel Youngblood, you know, that arm he had in right field. So there were a lot of very likable players on this team. You know, Steve Henderson hit 306. So as I think about 1979, yeah, they were terrible. And they went into, they had some amazing losing streaks, amazingly bad losing streaks. And the pitching was horrific. You know, when I believe Kevin Kobel was maybe the best pitcher they had. I think he might have been their best starter. They had Pat Zachary, you had guys like Andy Hassler, Doc Ellis, you know, Kevin Kobel, like I said before. So the pitching was in tatters, but there were some fun guys on there. So I look back at 79 in this way. I didn't hate the team. I hated the outcome. And those were in the days before I was old enough to drive, so I used to have to be taken to games. And they were so bad that we only went to one game that year because, you know, the family was like, no, we're not going to waste money on this. We just can't do it. We can't justify it. And that's clearly how all the Met fans felt because they drew, like you said, about 700,000 people, which in New York City for baseball, National League Baseball in New York City, when you draw 700,000 people, you really have to take a look at what the hell is going wrong. I mean, seriously, there have been, you know, in 1962, the Mets drew over a million, right? You know, the worst team in history of baseball. This team draws 700,000. What was it? I mean, was it, okay, look, the Seaver trade, the shock of that was over, but now it was like we're in the middle of this abyss and there's no way out. And the fans are like, I'm like my family, we're just not going to spend money on this. Maybe that's what everybody thought. But anyway, that's my take on it. I don't look back at it, you know, and retch and want to vomit because I did like a lot of the players individually. It just it didn't work. You know, it was a bad team that got really bad results. And as I think about that team, I think about the horrific pitching they had.
Yeah, no, you're right, Rich. You know, when you're that age, these guys are ultimately going to be heroes to you. I loved John Stearns. I loved, as you say, Joel Youngblood. So, you know, any day at the ballpark was a fun day at the ballpark for me watching these guys. Ed Cranepool retired, and Lee Mazzilli, let's not forget, hit a home run in the All-Star game. So that's that, 1979. Well, unless you guys have any more outstanding issues?
Don't forget Skip Lockwood. Skip Lockwood was a top reliever with the Mets.
Yeah,
and I don't understand how they didn't trade him at the trade deadline to get somebody else, to get somebody good. Then he left after that year and went to the Red Sox as a free agent.
We'll have to ask
hold on to that.
We had him on once, so we'll have to ask him that.
You know what? I'd be remiss if I didn't also include in this conversation Joe McDonald. I think he goes very underappreciated for what he did for this organization as a scouting director and as an executive. He left behind a lot of good players that ultimately we either retained or traded away that helped us build that 86 championship. Joe McDonald, I was always a proponent of him being in the Mets Hall of Fame. I think that conversation needs to be revisited again in a future podcast.
Yes.
But unless, gentlemen,
he gets a bad rap, too, on the Seva deal. I think that he had no choice. I mean, he just had no choice. Grant was adamant about getting Seva out of New York.
Here's the problem too is that 1979, no matter how bad 1980 was, it was the magic is back. You know, it's new ownership. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
As we have kind of related at certain points this year, even though I think this is actually definitely a better ownership in general than that one. But you know, in terms of 1979, you're talking about from 1977 through 1979, a big reason Seaver was shipped out was because the Mets in the shadows, contrasting the Yankees, who were winning championships with free agency, the Mets weren't doing anything to reinforce these players that you guys remember very fondly. Had those players had reinforcements, even with the Seaver deal, you know, it's just like if you still include the fact is that the Seaver deal, a big reason why Seaver was upset was because of free agency. But if you just even don't include, like, they get rid of Seaver and it's like, all right, now we're going to the 78 and 79 squad. They could have done that to reinforce these players who could potentially be all-stars. Pat Zachary could have potentially been an all-star. Steve Henderson could have potentially been an all-star. This could have potentially been a great Mets era, but instead you're only left to remember how great the uniforms are on some of the best players that have ever entered your perception of baseball. That's where the legacy is with the late 70s Mets is non-reinforcement.
This truly was the end of the initial era. John Payson and Casey Stengel had passed away a couple of years prior. As Stephen brought up, Linda DeRolle, she was in charge and about to sell the team. The Wilpons and Mr. Doubleday, they took over the following year. So, you know, the initial era of Mets baseball officially came to an end in 1979. That being said, gentlemen, if you have any outstanding issues, rude remarks, comments, get them off your chest now. Otherwise, we'll move into our final word. Going once, going twice. Stephen, thank you so much for your time. You're a great guest. We always have the door open to you.
My pleasure.
You walk
thank
in
you.
Anytime.
My pleasure. Always love interacting with you fellas.
Kindly, sir. Rich, I will start with you. Your final word, sir.
Two words, hyphenated word. Buckle up. The schedule is going to be rough, folks. You know, they have 18 games the next 17 days before the All-Star game. They're playing the Yankees in there. They've got the Phillies. They've got the Brewers who are playing good ball. They've got to go to Atlanta. So not that any schedule is, quote, easy, but buckle up. It's going to be a rough ride to the All-Star game. And I hope, you know, I'm somewhat confident, and I hope they can be in first place come the All-Star break. That's where I am.
Steven, take a moment out, please. Tell us what you're doing, where we can find it, you know, what you're up to these days. And by all means, your final word. Thank you, sir.
Well, not much of anything, really. Just trying to get back to some sort of normalcy. You always find me on Twitter, at Cranepool. I'm always there. I may have a couple of other things. Probably I'm waiting for some confirmation or something, and I can announce something that I'll be involved in. And just, you know, hoping for good health for this team. If this team stays healthy, get everybody back, they're as good as anybody in baseball.
They're as good as any team. We in the before the season started, we saw teams. Everybody thought the Dodgers were the runaway team. They're not. Everybody thought the Braves were going to give us a big trouble. They haven't. We're the team. We're the lead dog in this division right now. We have the best pitcher in the planet. We have a team that is cohesive, that is looking to win, wants to win, will sacrifice to win. And I think, hopefully we get out to the ballpark and cheer the team. I was hoping to go a couple weeks ago. The one game I pick, it gets rained out. So now I have to look at my schedule and get out there again. I'm dying to get back out to Citi Field. I was at the Barclays Center for Game 5 for the Nets and Bucks, and it was great to be in that kind of atmosphere, and that's what I want to be in at Citi Field. Hopefully in October, postseason baseball, hopefully we get there, because this seems to be now the tide is turning for New York sports. The teams are starting to get better. The teams are starting to advance and have sights on championships. Let's hope our team, the Mets, are the first one to break through and win a championship.
Well said, well said.
Woo!
I will say,
beautiful word.
I will say, let's go Mets. We're in first place. Let's enjoy it. It was great having the band back together again this evening. And, Steven, it's always such a pleasure speaking with you. I will leave it off on that. Pass it off to Sam. Bring us home.
Watch out for Washington. They're creeping right up behind us. One of the reasons is because they're 9-1. They just beat us 3 out of 4. Be careful. They are now in second place in front of Atlanta and Philadelphia, who are both 5 games behind us, with Miami 9 games behind us. That is basically where I'm going to leave it off. You have that 4-game lead. Luckily, the team you're about to play 4 games against is now 5 games ahead. That was what I said a few days ago, I believe, needed to be the goal going into the Atlanta series, is make sure going into the Philly series that you are at least five games ahead of Philadelphia. And that is exactly what happened, even though Washington is now in second place at 4 games behind us. So right now we have a first place lead to protect against a team that is 5 games ahead of us. Behind us, anything can happen this weekend. But right now we know exactly where we are. We know exactly what we need to do going into this Philadelphia series, and that is win. And I hope for a sweep. And the only way to finish this going into that potential sweep is let's go Mets. Let's go Mets. Let's go Mets.
Go
stop
Mets.
This before I start singing the song, as I am wont to do. Let's go Mets, everybody. Take care. Thanks, Steven.
Good night.
Thanks, Reggie.
Steven, thanks,
Mike.
Thank you. Good night.